Hello and welcome to Sci-Fi.
Sci-Fi?
Sci-Fi.
Yes, Sci-Fi, 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 a podcast where we put light into books. Or something like that.
I feel like I just got lit.
Light around books.
You always seem to be a little bit lit to me.
That's so lit.
Yeah, exactly. Who chose this week?
It is I.
Who are you?
Adam One. Well, not really, but...
There should be like an Adam West.
What about an Adam North?
Yes. That too. All right. What is this week's book?
The Year of the Flood by Margaret Atwood, 2009.
Who narrated it?
Bernadette Dunn, Katie McNichol, and Mark Bramhall.
Whose side are you on?
That would be telling.
I think we've used that joke before, but still.
Hey, it'll last forever. It's hilarious every time.
Exactly. It's an evergreen joke.
It's yes. Evergreen. All right. Could you give us a reading from the back of the book? And I don't know. I'll ring a bell or something if you get anything wrong.
Good idea. Get out the kettle prod. The times and species have been changing at a rapid rate, and the social compact is wearing as thin as environmental stability. Adam One, the kindly leader of the God's Gardeners, a religion devoted to the melding of science and religion, as well as the preservation of all plant and animal life, has long predicted a natural disaster that will alter Earth as we know it. Now it has occurred, obliterating most human life. Two women have survived. Ren, a young trapeze dancer locked inside the high-end sex club Scales and Tails, and Toby, a God's Gardener barricaded inside a luxurious spa where many of the treatments are edible. Have others survived? Ren's bio-artist friend Amanda, Zeb, her eco-fighter stepfather, her one-time lover Jimmy, or the murderous painballers, survivors of the mutual elimination painball prison, not to mention the shadowy, corrupt policing force of the ruling powers. Meanwhile, gene-spliced life forms are proliferating. The lion-lamb blends, the mohair sheep with human hair, the pigs with human brain tissue. As Adam One and his intrepid hemp-clad band make their way through this strange new world, Ren and Toby will have to decide on their next move. They can't stay locked away.
All right. Barry, what did you think?
I really like this book.
Mm-hmm.
I think that this reading was actually more terrifying than the first couple of times I've read this book, especially given our current political climate slash, you know, corporate, you know, power grab thing that's going on these days.
Closer, closer.
Yes. Also, you know, chronologically speaking, this is actually closer to, you know, our actual future than Oryx and Crake.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so.
I actually believe that, you know, God's Gardeners and is actually a fairly realistic response to what might be going on now.
Well, yeah, I think that this is sort of brilliant as usual for Atwood. And it's sort of tempting to say, oh, yeah, Margaret Atwood was brilliant. Yeah, whatever. But no, I mean, one should call out the fact that she's brilliant every time. You know, and I do love like the names she comes up with for the different products. But here she gets to invent a whole new religion. I guess she's done that before. But, you know, she gets to invent a somewhat sympathetic, or at least a religion that I found somewhat sympathetic.
Well, it melds science with religion, right?
Exactly.
You'd worship at the altar of the atom.
Right. And as for the reading of the book here, the narrators do a great job, and then there are fully produced versions of the songs in the book, which ironically, you know, were both fantastic, but also kind of took me a little bit out of it because I'm just like, you know, I'm imagining that, you know, we're going along and suddenly the entire cult bursts into, like, turns into a rock group. And
this sounds awesome.
I mean, it's awesome, but it just
doesn't. I mean, that's kind of like, you know, bobbing around in the car, driving down the road.
Sure.
You know, listening to the songs.
Going, but I'm just like,
I need to get the CD.
This technophobic cult that doesn't even use computers suddenly has this full, you know, production suite hidden around the corner someplace. So, you know, it's too good is what I'm saying.
Their only physical media of this music is actually produced on an LP that you actually have to hand crank a, you know, record player.
Right. And it's somehow made out of leaves.
Yes. Recycled kudzu leaves and, you know, mulch.
Right. So I began the book sort of wondering, oh, are they going to sort of cross paths at any point with any of the characters from the original Oryx and Crake? And I had my eyes wide open for, you know, of the little cameos that I expected. There's a lot more than cameos. They're very closely tied together narratives. And on the one hand, it's sort of awesome to see the backstory that we missed in Oryx and Crake. And on the other hand, there's a lot of coincidences sort of required to make this work. And that took me out of the book a little bit. And it felt to me like it sort of took some of the focus off of these characters that now we're trying to get to know a little bit. But still, I think that this is an amazing novel and it's part of an amazing series.
Indeed. Yeah, actually, I kind of wondered, was this intentionally part of the story when she first wrote Oryx and Crake? You know, did she intend to have a sequel? Was this just something that didn't kind of fit in the first time? Or did she, you know, essentially retcon it, or did it just kind of happen, you know, whatever?
Right. I would make a bet that she didn't fully script this out initially, that, well, the stuff that I'll get into in the right. spoiler section.
Yeah. I mean, it doesn't matter either way, but I'm always curious with this kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of weird because I was thinking about, well, you know, they're essentially narratives that take place in parallel with Oryx and Crake and this one. And in a sense, I actually think I like this book better than Oryx and Crake. And I was also kind of thinking, I suppose you could read them in either order, technically. You know, there would be some benefit in either direction, I think. But
I think you'd be a little confused at the end, what's going on, not knowing who Snowman and...
Yeah, that would make no sense, I guess, because they didn't explain that stuff.
I think this book starts, you know, just offset from the beginning of Oryx and Crake, and then, you know, continues a little bit further past that book, but it's, you know, fully overlapping.
Sure.
For a majority of it.
I would say this series has to be probably the most literary post-apocalypse series that I'm aware of, and I think this one is probably my favorite of the three overall. It's been a while since I've read the third one, but it's definitely something like Barry was saying with the God's Gardeners, where when I was reading it going, yeah, in that situation, I could totally see myself sliding into being a member of the God's Gardeners.
You definitely want to be an Adam or Eve though.
Eventually. Yeah. Hmm. It's sort of like this book is the perspective mostly from the point of view of people that are middle and lower class, you know, that live in the plebe lands, or, you know, worse, essentially. And whereas Oryx and Crake was mostly from the point of view of upper middle and upper class.
Yeah.
And kind of how it, you know, how they deal with everything. And, you know, so I thought it was interesting just to see another kind of point of view in detail, but also, like you were saying, it's kind of like this eco-cult, essentially, you know, greeny cult or whatever they called it. Mm-hmm. I can see that easily happening, especially where they essentially take over these buildings that they don't exactly own, they kind of said, but they're just kind of occupying them. And you could see in, like, you know, slum areas that could easily happen.
There are cults that are somewhat like this.
Yeah.
Right.
Freegans, yeah. That sort of thing.
And yeah, so I'm sure there's precedent for that. And I know Atwood does often say that, you know, I don't know if it always is true, but she'll often put in things that have actually happened, mm-hmm. you know, in some cases. She doesn't, you know, she's like, well, you know, I'm not making this stuff up. This has happened somewhere else before, you know, maybe it's putting them in a different arrangement or something. But so, yeah, I give it N thumbs up.
Wow. That's quite a few, or maybe no thumbs.
Where N tends towards infinity, asymptotically.
Okay, well, after that.
Here to unheard, you know, rating system from Kevin.
Asymptotic. After that.
There's science in there.
Is there like some sort of Zeno's thumb in here somewhere as
oddly
well?
Oddly open-ended Zeno's review.
Also, I like bees, so, you know. If you like bees, there's things in the book about bees that are good. I will mention here, I guess, the music selections in the book. They're, you know, selections from a hymnal that, you know, Adam One's giving a sermon and then they sing some song. You know, so in the audio version, you basically get the CD versions that were done by Orville Stober from the CD Hymns of the God's Gardeners, which if you look in the back of some printings of the book, Atwood basically says, you know, he kind of got the book and said, well, this would be interesting. No, I should just mess around with these, and kind of ended up writing all these in a couple or 3 weeks or something. And,
right.
You know, so.
Again, I should say that my criticism of these is that they are too good.
Yeah. Well, she did say that, you know, again, sort of in the very back, you know, the last page of the book where she's giving credits and stuff, that the Gardeners are not based on any extent religion, but that she kind of did get inspiration from certain religious hymnals and that, you know, exist in the last couple centuries. And
sure.
And they were intended to be things that, you know, anybody could sing with whatever quality of, you know, voice you have.
It's all about being part of a group and feeling included.
Well, she did give permission for amateur, devotional, or environmental purposes, use of the hymn, so.
So wait, I can start my own religion?
Yes, but you can't make money off of it.
That's true.
I'll consider myself a non-profit.
With a PH.
Ding.
Oh, God.
Wow.
Okay. All right. Well, on that note, speaking of bees, I think a bee has flown in here, so we've got to carefully shoo it out and not kill it, or else the podcast episode will be bad somehow.
Or worse.
Maybe it's too late.
Yeah.
We shall return, for we are sci-fi.
Sci-fi.
And welcome back to our discussion of The Year of the Flood by Margaret Atwood. So, a lot of the book talks about God's Gardeners, this sort of relatively smaller, mid-sized cult of radical environmentalists. And in other reviews, I've seen it described as sort of people saying they had trouble believing in this, you know, out there religion. And
really? I don't really have a problem believing this.
Exactly.
There's that was way more out there than religion.
To me, I was just like, this is one of the most
believable things.
Believable, sympathetically described new religious movements I've ever seen. You know, aside from, you know, the whole scientists that doubt God are complete idiots thing at the beginning, I kind of believe a lot of the things they're saying. I mean, you know, hell, I'll go out for a hamburger, but
secret burger.
Exactly.
Yeah, I actually think that you could actually see this happening today if we just push a little bit harder, and it wouldn't just be like one side of the political spectrum to me. Mm-hmm. I think you'd see a lot of people from the political right, you know, out in the rural areas wanting to do something like this.
Right.
You know, and in this near future that she's created, it's really even all the plebe lands have become basically our suburbs, and there are no rural areas. Right. So this is the political right, you know, quote, rural folk, plus the politically left, you know, people who don't agree with what's going on, and the power structure sort of, you know, wrapping around and meeting on the other end of the political spectrum and going like, what do we call ourselves? God's Gardeners.
Yeah. Well, there's a certain Buddhist aspect to it because certain groups of Buddhism, I guess, where they have reverence for all life and they don't want to even say swat a fly or something like that. And
yeah. Well, right. I think you even see the people of some of the people of Tibet who most of the people in Tibet are Buddhist.
Sure.
Right. They actually remove all the earthworms from a construction area before they do any construction. So they minimize, you know, loss of life there.
Mm-hmm. Right. There's definitely overlaps in the book where they, you know, relocate the slugs and the rats and stuff to other buildings when instead of killing them. There was one saint or feast day where they say, you know, you wish for all souls to gain enlightenment, essentially. And like, you know, that's definitely, you know, a Buddhist thing, right? You know, it's like, no, you know, yes, even Hitler, yes, even, you know, people we don't agree with, they all should attain enlightenment or whatever, you know?
Yeah. Even at the end of the book, I think they end up, it happens to fall on that particular day of the calendar after they've wrapped up the pain ballers and imprisoned them. You know, like, well, we're going to give them food because it's, you know, this particular saint's day. And
right.
She's like, well, do we have to? And she's like, yeah, it's because it's.
And the interesting thing is the person that's in charge at that point, Toby, is not exactly certain what she believes. I mean, she's become an Eve and she's sort of fallen hard orthoprax, shall we say. She has been following this religion, but she's always sort of had a foot out the door. She's not somebody who had some sort of radical transformation at any point. She went into the cult because it was her way out of a bad situation.
And she ended up becoming an Eve just by the fact that Pilar died, and that was sort of her, you know, one of her last desires.
Yes, mm-hmm. Kind of through attrition. And yeah, it is funny because, you know, she's like, well, I always wanted to keep my options open.
Right.
And even though she's been there for like, you know, 4 or 5 years at that point at least. And And right, she does say she had one transformative kind of spiritual moment when she first like came into the garden, and it was such a huge difference from the outside slums, basically.
Yeah.
And
she had a much different view of the gardens, you know, thinking, you know, coming from the, you know, the outside of the, you know, in the plebe lands where everything's like hot and dry and dusty. And,
right.
you know, she came to the garden and realized it was, you know, very lush and, you know, not dry and dusty like she had thought.
It, right. It was pretty funny. Adam asked her to become an Eve, and she's kind of like, you know, hemming and hawing, like, I don't really know if I believe in this stuff. And he's like, that's good, because, you know, action precedes faith in our religion, basically.
Right.
And he's like, you know, you're even that you're honest, you know, makes me want you to be an Eve even more. And she's like, damn, this isn't working. Like, and he's like, well, at least, you know, take some mushrooms or whatever it was, you know, do a vigil and ask for, you know, guidance. And, you know, she sees some like glowing, you know, animal that like yawns at her or something like that.
And, and then she falls asleep.
Yeah. And then she's like, you know, it's like, yeah, it was this glowing animal that like looked kind of like a Lyobam or something. I'm not sure. And then she's like, you know, it's not very, you know, decisive, a yawning animal, like, you know, and, you know, everyone else like, oh, that's a good sign. That's
great. Oh, you saw a yawning animal. That means you believe now. No, I don't. But yeah, no, my take on it is it's sort of a contradictory portrayal in some ways, because they're portrayed as sort of paranoid. They think that everybody's out to get them, but everybody's out to get them.
Right.
It's not paranoia if everybody is actually out to get you.
Right. They believe that the world is going to come to an end soon.
True.
It does.
The waterless flood, yes.
Let's see. They are completely nonviolent. You know, this is sort of flipped on the other end. They're completely nonviolent. And yet, in some ways, they inspire and are somewhat complicit in the world's eventual human extinction event.
Right. Yeah. Unexpectedly and kind of not intentionally. You know, it's like because Zeb spins off and, you know, forms the Mad Adam group, which is sort of like the militant version of God's Gardeners, where he's like, oh, yeah, he didn't want to kill people, but he thought if they destroy the infrastructure, people would, you know, stop wasting and using up everything and, you know, the Earth could recover.
Yeah. I mean, there's this heavy intersection with the players of Extinctathon and right. other games, right? Which,
right.
You know, I'm not sure if is God's Gardeners, you know, a creation of these people, you know, and they're using Adam One as sort of a front, a prop or something right. like that.
I mean,
you know, and this is a proper cult, right? You know, like mm-hmm. Kevin was just saying a little while ago, like, you know, when she had her vision, he's like, yep, that means that, you know, you're doing it right. You know, it's like you tell people what, you know, what convinces them to stay and to participate more.
Exactly.
And that they, you know, they're being included in this, you know, special group of people.
And the weird thing is Adam One is this very reasonable guy, but he seems to know how to talk to get what he wants to a terrifying degree. Like this idea of, oh, the fact that you doubt makes it even more important that you do this.
Right. You could convince people, you know, use their own doubt against them.
Right.
Right.
And on the one hand, you know, part of me sort of agrees with that. Oh, hey, I'm a doubter. He's praising me. Yay.
I have another biscuit.
Yeah, exactly. And on the other hand, you know, of course, it's a trap. I mean, you know, you can't say, oh, you doubt me, therefore you agree with me. That's madness.
Right.
Well, it was also interesting because, you know, at one point he's saying, well, you know, the gardeners have to be kind of a beacon of hope to people, because he's like, if people think that they have no hope at all, they'll do worse than nothing. You know, they'll kind of go the other way and just like, you know, burn it to the ground or just, you know, help out the corpse or whatever. Mm-hmm. I did find it amusing, you know, speaking of that, the corpsey corpse, which right. is, you know, seems very in audio, it's a little bit less obvious versus reading it that it's like, you know, corpse, basically.
I actually read that as a corporate security corporation.
I think that's kind of what it's supposed to be
originally. But
when you read it, you know, written out, it looks like it says, you know, corpse corporation, basically, or something like that. And
right. The only part that really took me out of the book, at the same time, I kind of perversely appreciate it in a weird way, is that there were so many coincidences and entanglements with Oryx and Crake let's say, for example, you know, isn't it a bit odd that Jimmy, the world's most unimportant person, he's had two girlfriends that are members of the same small cult.
who both happen to be.
Right.
Yeah.
That were best friends. He's never figured this out. And
not that he would actually care. So that's within character. But
I mean, yeah, that's the sort of thing. I'd like to think that I would notice that and it would actually drive me nuts. I would basically spend the rest of my life being assuming that everybody else I met was also part of the same cult.
You know, God's gardeners is a dating pool. What?
Yeah, you could basically like, oh, well, I'm going to head over to God's gardeners. Maybe somebody else wants to date me.
GG.com.
I guess it's somehow part of the religion. But the thing that was interesting to me about Jimmy in the first place was that he's just a regular guy that just winds up being swept up in events because he was friends with this other guy.
Yeah.
Right.
And his friendship of Glenn is basically his one claim to fame.
Exactly. And it gives him this sort of weird form of importance that everybody in the world seems to have dated him. And yes, on the other hand, Jimmy does seem to, you know, sleep with anything that moves and is self-involved enough that he might not actually notice that everyone that was dating him was part of a cult.
I guess after reading Oryx and Crake, I mean, you kind of knew he was sleazy.
Sure.
Right. We just didn't know like how, you know, deep this was, you know, how deep seated of a thing it was with him, you know, not knowing his dating history.
I actually think that in some ways this portrays a slightly more positive variant on Jimmy because
I find that surprising.
We don't get the long discussions of him describing child porn, for example. Which,
right. So it's a watered down child porn serial.
He was a dater. Child at the time, right?
But, I mean, yeah, it was
disturbing.
But we're seeing the view of him from people that love him that are sort of outside of these inner circles. And yeah, he's, you know, this self-involved guy that sleeps with a lot of people. And, but I think, you know, the biggest thing that we get is that his, oh, I'm broken inside and, you know, I've got to get away from you to keep from hurting you.
Yeah.
Is his go-to line. That's right, what he says to all the girls.
He's like, maybe I'm just broken because, you know, I mess everybody up.
Right. But I think that he had actually mentioned that was sort of his recurring line in the previous book.
Yeah, I think he's not oblivious of that. That's just his convenient, like, you know, way he deals with it.
Right.
So in some ways in this book, you know, hearing more how imperfect he is actually makes you feel
a little sympathetic.
More sympathetic to him than how you might have felt about him in Oryx and Crake.
Right. But I mean, in some ways, I would have preferred just sort of seeing Glenn drift through because that's an important part of the narrative. And
you had exactly one sighting of him?
Exactly. And
he was in there two or three times.
Was he?
Yeah.
Yeah, three or four times maybe.
Okay.
Yeah, he was. He brought the honey. He brought jars.
At the beginning, yeah.
Pilar's biopsy, and then he showed up at Pilar's mulching, as you put it. Her composting.
Right. But if you weren't looking for him, you wouldn't have noticed that.
Yeah. I think you have to pay attention to when, because they don't mention it was Glenn. They just say, oh yeah, he knew her.
But I think these guys were probably a bit amused because at the beginning, I'm just like, okay, I spotted Glenn. And oh, is that the same Jimmy? Yeah, it's the same Jimmy. Okay. Now it's the Jimmy show. Yeah.
Glenn shows up at Scales and
yeah, exactly.
Talks with Ren. Yeah, actually, the thing about you were talking about, you know, too much coincidence or not, and, you know, I kind of also thought, well, you know, there's the whole part of God's Gardeners where they say, oh, you know, there is no such thing as coincidence. You know, it's just another name for miracle and stuff like that. And, you know, if you're not into that, you kind of like go roll eyes and stuff. But
I mean, yes, that was the only part. Well, one of the parts where I'm just like, you know, there is no such thing as coincidence. Yes, there is.
Yes, there is. It's a miracle. So, but then I'm like, well, I don't think this probably was it. But, you know, you think, did Margaret Atwood kind of say, well, you know, these aren't coincidences. I'm bringing these characters together because it's, quote, a miracle. You know, it is God's Gardeners. It's, you know, about sort of a biblical mirror.
Being manipulated by an all-powerful force named Margaret Atwood.
Well, that's true. So, I don't know. That was another thing that crossed my mind. I don't know if it has any credence or not, but
yes, I was also amused. Both Kevin and I came up with the same counter argument to this minor discussion that they were having about
Adam's teeth
as to, well, why does Adam have tearing canines or whatever the proper term might be?
Well, they basically said, why do humans not have herbivore teeth.
Right.
Because certainly the kids were like upset. They said, certainly God would have made Adam, you know, a plant eater. So why would he have omnivore teeth?
And they table the motion because they can't come up with any.
Yeah. They're possible. Like, they're like, maybe, you know, after the fall, you know, their teeth changed, you know, in order to eat meat. And then Adam one is like, we can't just make evolution work like we want it to, because we want to believe this, you know? So it's like, they do give, he does, you know, give science credence to things, right? You know,
yeah. Meanwhile,
or process anyway,
you know, when you guys are discussing this chat, I wake up and I look at this thing and I'm like, what the hell are you guys talking about?
Yes.
I mean, it
gives us a little glow when we can do that too.
Adam doesn't have herbivore teeth, 'cause he also has forward facing eyes, which are for predators. You know, if we were true herbivores, our eyes would be on the side of our head, 'cause we'd be cows and give us the best chance of seeing things coming. And
no, we want stereo vision, because that's a nice feature.
Yes. Well, we were both shouting free will, basically.
Yeah, because it's like, it seems and obvious to me. And so I'm wondering, you know,
I mean, free will is the obvious BS answer that a lot of
well, right. But it seemed logical from their point of view that exactly. You say, if God gave people and supposedly Adam free will, that he would be biasing the decision to be like omnivore or an herbivore or, you know, a meat eater, because right.
You can only make Adam an omnivore and then he can choose to right. Be an herbivore.
If you give him herbivore teeth, then you're basically biasing him against being able to eat meat easily, right?
Right. And so he can't have the the moral distinction of choosing vegetarianism.
Right.
Okay, well, we solved that. Yay!
So, anybody wants any more, you know, how many angels can dance on the head of a pin arguments? Yeah. Answer, please let us know.
We have a theological consulting service.
So, I guess one of the questions I had was, if the people who created and or ran the God's Gardeners group were really prepping people for the waterless flood, as they say, the end of the world, right? Why would they, I guess I'm trying to understand is why would they make them all vegetarians?
I think it happened the other way around. I think that there was this whole God's Gardeners group.
And they co-opted it?
And, well, also, there was that time when Ren comes back home, talks to Glenn, and he's very interested in the whole theology. Mm-hmm. So, in some ways, the flood, the actual, you know, plague event was based on the theology of the God's Gardeners.
Kind of. I mean, you know, that may not be the only reason, but I think, yeah, inadvertently, God's Gardeners spawned, you know, like you said, they essentially spawned some instance of what they right, wanted slash thought would happen.
Isn't this some sort of like time travel trope?
Yeah, a little bit. It's like 12 Monkeys, where, you know, right. Bruce Willis goes back in time and tries to convince the guy in the past, Brad Pitt, I guess, that, you know, oh, you're the guy that wants to destroy the world with the 12 Monkeys thing. And just, oh, good idea.
I did do the nasty in the pasty.
Exactly. You know, he causes the thing that he's trying to avoid, which I think is the plot of that entire movie. Spoilers!
And yet another thing we ruined.
Yes, well.
Well, if they go back in time.
Exactly. I tried to prevent you, but... You
know. Yeah, I mean, I think the God's Gardeners is kind of a doom cult, but it's more of an eco cult. I think they started more as an eco cult, and like sort of the doom end of the world thing was kind of like, you can see it coming. Like now you could see it coming, but not that clearly. Like, you know, it's avertible now. At that time, maybe it didn't seem very avertible. And, you know, maybe it's not avertible now. It depends how much you believe in global warming and whether you can revert that or not, or whether it's really, you know, happening that badly or not.
But we're all doomed.
Yay!
We have a different cult.
Finally.com.
Look, we're just defining the parameters of our cult here. You two can join us. Please send $5 to Happy Dude at...
We'll come up with something.
I mean, so yeah, like we were saying earlier that the God's Gardeners, you could easily see it happening now. And in fact, a lot of things, you know, their tenets were sort of like, they're extreme recycling type people. You know, there's definitely stuff where they, you know, they're like, hey, you know, there's a whole circle of life and there's a whole section where, you know, Pilar dies. So they, you know, it's like, well, and you know, even one of the sermons is like, why would you, you know, try to, you know, preserve your body? You should donate your protein back into the ecosystem. You know, you've been taking other creatures' protein, you know, your whole life. You should sort of, you know,
give it back.
Yeah, give it back to the system, basically. You know, you're all part of the system. And
So I found it kind of interesting, you know, that I think a lot of people will think that this is some sort of new way of thinking, but I think if you roll the clock back about 80 years, say pre-World War II, right, you don't have a lot of hospitals. You may have like a country doctor, right? You reuse everything you possibly can.
Sure.
Right. You know, you literally do compost, you're dead. I mean, not necessarily for farming, but you know, you're bringing them back to the land when you bury them sort of, you know, out in the back in the family plot and
right.
things like that. And there's this, you know, strong, you know, belief in growing your own food.
Well, it's called not wanting to starve.
Right. But in some ways it's, you know, we talk about it like it's some sort of like new thing, but you know, to me, it's sort of like a, you know, almost kind of like going back to the, you know, quote, the old ways.
It's a regression to the mean.
Right.
Yeah. It always sort of amazes me when environmentalism is seen as all one side or the other of the political spectrum. When,
right.
Frankly,
when they're just right, damn it.
Well, kind of. I mean, speaking as somebody who does not really do a whole lot for the environmental movement, but sort of passive believes real hard. So
I have empathy.
You're welcome.
I have empathy, but not compassion. I feel bad about it, but I'm not willing to do anything.
Nope.
That damn external world.
Okay. So anyway, away from more terrifying subjects and more to the happier subject of being poisoned by mushrooms. So we have sort of a classic good versus evil thing set up between Toby and Blanco, who I briefly pictured as being Blanco from Street Fighter.
He seems too nice. Green furry mask.
this... you know, huge street thug who just becomes worse and worse over the course of the book, if anything.
Right. Yeah. You know, he starts out, you know, Toby gets her job at Secret Burger just to not starve to death, basically.
Right.
Secret Burger. You know,
when, you know, his previous girlfriend / employee, you know, leaves and he kills her to make a, you know, example, he's like, you know, invites her to the office and he's like, hey, see this heart tattoo? He's like, that means I love you. And now you love me too, right? And then she just can just nod, barely being able to breathe. And he's like, smart girl. And it's like, wow, it's terrifying. And so, yes, for the rest of the book, it's basically she's traumatized by him for the rest of her life still.
Sure.
For good reason. But,
well, they even went off and improved him by, you know, putting him into the paintball arena.
Right. Yes. He levels up.
We were thinking of giving you a sketch where we were all, you know, sportscasters narrating the paintball arena.
That would be a little too terrifying, I think.
May the odds ever be in your favor.
I was sort of thinking of like, okay, well, today nothing happened because we couldn't see anything.
That's because they don't have hover cameras.
Right, exactly. But at one point, Pilar teaches Toby about... poisonous mushrooms. And once that was there, I was thinking about, you know, there's the concept of, you know, Chekhov's gun, where once you show the gun on screen and, you know, somebody puts it in a drawer, you know that somebody has to use that by the end of it. I was thinking of that as Chekhov's mushroom, that somebody holds up the mushroom and, you know, then loads it and puts it in a desk drawer, and you know that somebody's going to get shot by that mushroom by the end.
Somebody pelted to death by it.
Well, she does, yes, very explicitly, you know, where she's like, oh, you know, this is the Amanita phalloides, the death cap, and, you know, it's all, you know, it's, you know, deadly and there's no antidote and stuff. And Toby's like,
I'm a little scared at how quickly he rattled that off, ladies and gentlemen.
I did learn it in seventh grade with my teacher who was a mycologist.
Was that also like a Chekhov's mushroom?
Is that teacher still alive?
Did they die mysteriously? I'm assuming they're fine.
After I gave them that drink that day and walked away forever.
There was a mushroom misidentification mishap.
Exactly.
MMM.
Right. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, Toby's sort of like, haha, Pilar, you're so nice and sweet. She's like, you know, who would you want to kill? And she just kind of looks at her and is like, well, you never know when you might have to use it, dear.
Yes.
And exactly. You're like, really? And so they do a sort of a quick, you know, where later on Pilar finds out, you know, via Glenn that she has some, you know, advanced cancer or something, and that's, you know, she's going to die. So she ends up towards the end deciding, okay, I'm just going to take the Amanita, right? And, you know, no. She takes it like
imagine that. What if Glenn was lying? Because now we know he's a bastard.
Well, I think they showed there's definite affection between Pilar and Glenn.
Sure.
Psychological.
it would not would be really within the realm of the book for him to be that far. That
he
much
would easily do it with a lot of people, I think.
Yeah.
If it served a political purpose, I think with her, they tried to show that's one of his few actual, you know, affectionate relationships seems to be with Pilar for some reason. I don't know why, but I guess they were both health wiser or something. Mm-hmm. But anyway, so, you know, Pilar takes that so she could, you know, kill herself in a nice way. You know, and then Toby kind of finds out about it after the fact, kind of freaks out. And
I mean, it is a measure of self-determinism, right?
Right.
I mean, being able to control your own future and, you know, what you're willing to not suffer and suffer.
Euthanasia.
Right. Yeah.
Right, right. And so then she has her poppy ready. So she's like, okay, well, when it starts hurting too much, then I'll take some poppy and that'll be enough. And that did seem to be in different dosages. That seemed to be a common gardener tea was poppy.
Hey, do you guys know I have hemlock growing in my backyard?
Oh, yay.
I really do.
I really believe you.
Is that your Greek garden or like a witch's garden or something?
It's actually just a weed.
So does that just give the honey from your backyard a little extra tingle?
Zing. God.
But you're right. Towards the end, and I actually thought it was interesting too, because Toby, she's at the Anuyu spa, right? Mm-hmm. She's on the roof. She sees, you know, a couple guys that are obviously sort of abusing this girl or a couple girls with them. And so she whips out her illegal rifle and, you know, shoots the guy that's holding her. And, you know, she doesn't know who it is. You know, it's Blanco, but she has no idea.
Right.
Later on, you know, totally unrelated, they're a week later or whatever, a few days later, they're leaving to go somewhere else. And they shelter in this room, and Blanco is in one of the rooms, and he's like half dead. He's like basically rotting.
Right.
And, you know, I think they said at one point
he's been gut shot.
Right. Yeah, so you don't get the sort of ending duel of the century or anything like that.
Yeah, he's been gut shot. And I think they even said that, you know, some animal had been like gnawing at his ribs or something. And so, you know, he would have just died within the next day by himself. And the weird thing is I kind of had remembered more of some kind of struggle or something. I think it was more the anticipation of that happening. The first time I read it, I was waiting for him to like be playing dead and then jump up and grab her and like, you right. know, something.
Yeah. Horror movie.
And they do describe that to some effect, right? You know, she's right. expecting him to do something, but nothing ever really comes of
it. He's moving to do that. He's crawling right. towards right. the door and she says,
he has a plan.
Oh, he was going to do this, but then she just like, here, have this nice drink.
Right. You know, so she just, you know, dumps in some poppy and Amanita and like, you know, into the drink. She's like, here, you know, because he's like, give me some water, you skinny bitch, which seems to be his word for any woman. Yes. But
exactly. But I mean, you know, and here again, we go into land of coincidences because I don't really have a sense of how big an area and how many people this is taking over. How unlikely is it that of all the people that she happens to run into Blanco?
Well, right. Like Ren and Amanda were dancing at Scales, right?
Right.
And, you know, they're thinking everyone else is dead, whatever. The song ends and there's like these three guys that, you know, are from Painball and they're just like, oh crap, we're dead. And Amanda's sort of like, quick, you know, let's try to, you know, get them drunk or whatever. And
right. Charm them.
And
it turns out that they're, you know, people that were also gardeners.
Like Crozier and Oates.
And she's like, is that Crozier? Is that Shacky or whatever? And so it's like,
and I was willing to give that the benefit of the doubt because they had come there because they had heard of that place.
Right.
You know, they kind of, I don't know if they knew particularly that Ren was there, but
I don't think they did, but you know, Scales from Blade Runner.
Right.
Yeah.
Which, not really, but I never got that before.
Or really?
Yeah. Well, I never got that before this time, but when I listened to it this time and I'm like, oh, they're talking about all of the scales and like whether they were growing on or whether they were, you know, is it painted on? And I'm like, oh my God, this is like that dance club in Blade Runner. I'm like, I don't know if that was intentional or not, but it's I could still see it happening either way.
Now I'm just seeing this sitcom set in that place called Taffy Lewis Can't Lose, but
God. And the image of, you know, because in this club, right, they all have, or not all of them, but many of them wear these like scale body suits, so they look like they're birds or that they're reptiles of some kind.
Very thematic.
And I also, it is very thematic, yes. And there are a lot of, you know, where people play animals or, you know, their identities are animals and things like that. Right. And especially dangerous ones. So, but I was thinking back to our opera, Oryx and Crake opera. I'm like, wow, this would definitely be like a ballet or an opera of like, you know, these characters with these like sequin, you know, feather or scale suits.
Yeah, I gave a disturbing amount of thought to exactly how the opera would be laid out. You know, there would be this entire song and dance like medley in the middle called Jimmy, I'm Counting on You, which is Jimmy letting people down left and right. And so the ending part where Crake says, Jimmy, I'm counting on you, is like this callback to it. Would be fantastic.
Like, I'm imagining where they're going in as if they're going to dance and he's going to like, you know, grab the woman and swing him around, but he never does and she just falls on the ground every time.
Nice.
It's like the equivalent of, you know, who is it? Lucy holding the football for Charles and Ryan runs up there.
And then the chorus is just Jimmy doing his routine about how he's so badly hurt inside that he hurts everybody else.
Right.
But he's really the victim here.
He's like, maybe I'm just broken.
Yeah, exactly.
This new feeling of terror that I don't usually experience from you guys.
So another thing that I thought was kind of interesting was you get this sort of subplot theme kind of sort of the effect of not even just cults or, you know, religious whatever, but basically any strong environment on children. Mm-hmm. And sort of like, you know, you could see how, you know, Ren comes out of it and she still thinks of like the feast days.
Right.
And she still like has trouble, you know, even considering eating meat, you know, makes her sick just, you know, thinking about it and that kind of stuff. And, you know, and Amanda didn't really believe it, but, you know, I think she took lessons from it. And, you know, and then on the other hand, Shaki and Croge and Oates and stuff, they kind of go off to the militant side, you know, end up essentially in prison, you know, and was it Bernice, the, you know, their friend that they're kind of, you know, were mean to.
Right.
She becomes extreme, you know, very extremist. She's not, I don't know if she's like doing terrorism really, but you know, they call her a terrorist basically by just, you know, her.
Well, she's kind of like a bioterrorist, right?
Right. I don't know that she actually did anything other than kind of show up and, you know, hold up signs or maybe the kind of like laying down in front of bulldozer kind of terrorists, right? Not like
those aren't stuff terrorists.
Up. That's what I mean. Quote terrorists. You know, right. I don't know that she was an actual terrorist. I think she just
demonstrated.
Yeah. But
I mean, like a lot of the Extinctathon players were actually bioterrorists, right? Even from Oryx and Crake, they were like the people who,
right.
You know, unleashed some sort of virus on the algae they had, you know, put into the roads to make them bioluminescent, and it actually caused the roads all to collapse for
like
500 miles in every direction.
And in this book, they said that most of those people were, you know, ex-god gardeners that, you know, went over to, because a lot of the god's gardeners were people that originally worked for corporations that were like geneticists and like, you know, that kind of stuff.
Right.
And they kind of decided this is, you know, I don't want to be doing this anymore. But then they decide, well, I do want to be doing it just, you know, for our cause instead of for the corporation. So they kind of went the enviro, you know, terrorists or whatever. And then
they all got wrapped up and had to go either get spray gunned or work for, it wasn't Healthwiser, but it was the other.
No,
was it Healthwiser?
No, it wasn't Healthwiser. It was, I forget where Crake was working at the time.
Yeah.
Or like Crick and Watson Crick or something like that.
No,
or
was that the school, I think, but yeah.
Yeah.
But it's all right. Doesn't matter.
Yeah. So, right. It was basically the God's Gardeners.
They went to work on the
turned into
pill.
Mad Adam. And then, as they said, you know, Crake turned them all in so he can get his own group of people to do what he wanted. Because, you know, someone working for the company would never agree to do this stuff, but the kind of already fringe and, you know, environmental terrorists would just be like, well, we don't, you know, we're getting killed anyway.
We kind of got nothing to lose.
We kind of half agree with some of the stuff. So whatever.
All right. Let's see. Did we want to talk about bees?
Bees. Yes. I mean, it wasn't a main part, but it was, you know, there was definitely sort of a recurring theme of, you know, bees having certain meanings in different situations and, you know, Pilar's, you know, kind of the ones that take care of the bees. And so as Toby sort of learns from Pilar, she, you know, tells all these things like, oh, well, you have to tell the bees the news.
And it was sort of an interesting view into how Toby treats a lot of things, because just like she is with the God's Gardeners, she's just like, okay, I don't believe in any of this stuff, but I will go and talk to the bees because I said I would. And then she keeps doing it because, this is how she was taught, even though she doesn't rationally believe that the bees actually understand her. But then she keeps on sort of buying into it more and more.
Well, I think even, close to the end, she kind of, convinces herself that they actually are listening, mm-hmm. And it's not just, oh, they're not just landing on me to,
right.
Wick some moisture off my skin or something.
Right. Though, I got the impression that she never fully convinced herself, that she was still mostly rational about it, but was doing it to make herself feel better or something like that. It was sort of this.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I don't know.
Yeah,
I think there's even scenes where it's like a lot of the insects, land on her as she's, kind of out there working, right. working her garden and stuff like that. She would say like, oh, the three butterflies came over and, came to land on me, and I think it's really just because they want some salt.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, like she had the ones where when Pilar died, and I think she said something about the bees. I don't remember what it was now, but it seemed like she said, "Oh, was that did the bees do something a little differently? Right as she died or something."
She was sort of trying to interrogate the situation. She was sort of like, "Yeah, well, was there something different happening?" She couldn't quite decide if it was just
right. And when she tells the bees, hey, this is happening, I'm going to be the new person now. And they're,
I will be your Eve 6. And that was actually kind of the mystical experience that really convinced her in some ways, because now she's told the bees that she's going to be the next Eve. So now she has to do it.
And
it's sort of how I get involved in a lot of volunteer activities.
And, I think it's, it's interesting because she's, she says she's been taught, if you don't tell them the news, their feelings will be hurt and they'll swarm, right. if you don't tell them the news, you don't tell them this is happening and stuff like that. And so when Blanco and company were attacking the gardeners at one time, the bees, she's like, okay, bees, kind of be prepared or something like that. She says something about it, what's happening, and they swarm the people right in front of her and attack them, kind of like apparently protecting Toby or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, then she comes back and she sort of like, gives the words of thanks and apology and whatever, that they have. They don't ever say what they are, but they, they reference them a lot. And, a lot of them, gave their lives to protect her and in the garden and stuff like that. But,
all right, so I guess it's time for our usual questions. Do we have favorite scenes, first of all?
I really liked Pilar's composting scene for some reason. It kind of made me think it's like some sort of like one big thumb in the eye of the man. Yes. last attempt at, saying F you.
So, yes, you indicated in one of these messages back and forth that you wanted us, your fellow podcasters to mulch you.
Yes, you guys are going to have to mulch / compost me over here at the park across the street.
Okay, sure, well, no, I guess we know what we have to do.
You have to do it in secret.
Okay. Do we have to wait till you're dead?
Yes.
Okay, damn it. Shouldn't have asked.
It's better to ask for forgiveness.
And don't put me in the sandbox the kids play there.
See, I would think that the God's Gardeners would sort of think that being redistributed as part of a secret burger would be like the highest form of recycling.
I am now part of all of you who ate me.
I think they just wouldn't want the profits to go to that corporation.
Yeah, I think so. Kevin, did you have any favorite scenes?
Actually, it was really kind of hard for me to pick one scene because it's like the entire book. I'm like, which one? This is a good one.
Oh,
this is a good one. I think I had to narrow it down to kind of just general sort of like the flashbacks to the God's Gardeners and kind of the, Pilar teaching Toby stuff, that kind of stuff. And
I mean, for me, the most vivid scene was with Ren in the, at Scales, and Jimmy shows up and she was like, servicing him, and right. He doesn't even know. He's completely smashed.
Right.
And she's like, was this horrible? Was this awesome? It kind of was both.
Yeah. She's like, does it have to be one or the other?
Right. Exactly.
Right. I did one scene that kind of stuck out for no good reason, I think, is where Toby kind of went back and was comforting, I think it was Vina or somebody. Mm-hmm. I forget who it was now, but you know, she needed like poppy tea for headaches or something.
Right.
And Newell was complaining about, or not Newell, but whoever it was complaining about Zeb and about how he never paid attention to her. And I think what it's more that I liked about it was not necessarily the subject of her saying stuff, but you know, it would say like, oh, and she was always so eco, and why was this happening, and why is that? And it seems like Margaret Atwood does a really good job at kind of writing internal monologues and kind of retellings of other things in a way that seems very realistic.
Right.
It kind of just flows out like it would really be. And I think just, I don't know, this, that aspect of her writing where like, cause a lot of this book was kind of internal monologues.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so I think it worked quite well.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. Okay. Let's see. So the usual questions, we sort of answered the tea question. There's lots of tea, but it was all herbal.
And some mushroom tea.
Poppy,
mushroom
chamomile, tea. Yes. A little mushroom tea.
I'd be willing to forgive them if they would just give me a little bit of poppy tea. Actually, a whole lot of poppy tea. Let's see. What character would you want to be, and or who would you be? As usual, I'm closer to Jimmy than I would like to admit, but not in that way. And let's see. I think I'm closest to Toby because, you know, I would sort of be going along with this bizarre cult that had saved my life, even though on some level I didn't really believe it.
Well, you shouldn't have kicked Blanco in the head that time.
I really shouldn't have.
Yeah, no, I think I would be a God's gardener for sure, but I'm not entirely sure
you're not.
That's what I was saying. I think I could see this happening now, basically. I think I'd be Pilar or something like that, except for hopefully not the part where I'm fatally whatever soon.
Yes, yes.
Well, in some ways, it's probably a better end than actually having to suffer through the waterless flood.
Yep.
Yeah, in theory.
I couldn't pick which of God's gardeners I might be, but I think I also finally decided I would also be Pilar. You know, I've got bees and zucchini and beans in my backyard and tomatoes.
Yeah, and you're like, yep, the bees are my friend. I talk to them.
That's right. Go forth my bee army and smite that guy who let his dog poop in my front yard.
Well, you should go down to the main street there and be a young bionaire. You can collect wine before the winos get it and then make your own vinegar and then sell it.
I also collect all the soap from everybody's trash.
Yeah. Some company is doing that now. They're recycling soap ends and like remanufacturing new soap or something. But
is it eco soap?
I think they're remanufacturing in like other countries, but that is something that's happening. We can go, sell it at the Gardener's Tree of Life Natural Minerals Exchange, which... Maybe we could start that.
It will be funded by the proceeds of our musical.
Hey, if Margaret Atwood would like to see an opera of this, we will gladly donate time. I know that we are obviously the go-to people when you need opera of dystopic fiction, hopefully fiction of some kind.
Maybe we could break out some mulch juice and, you know, recycle kudzu leaves.
Yeah, I did like that section where she was
I thought of you immediately.
To make up. She's like, no, don't you know, bottled water is evil.
That's right.
A happy cuppa is a crappy cuppa. You are so backsliding, Barry.
Shut up, meat breath.
Gang.
Green.
Yes.
All right. Well, I think I've seen the bees swarming, so I think it's time for us to tell us that although this podcast is ending, we will in fact return, for we are Sci-Fi.
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 So if you would like to reach us, we are available on Twitter via SF3 Podcast, via email at sf3podcast@gmail.com, and via Apple Podcasts at sci-fi, 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 or SF3. Bzzz.